dribble and plop. The dust soaks from his skin. His every pore opens and eases the stress from him. He takes the water into his mouth, tasting the soap, tasting himself, and spurts it back out. He likes to pretend sometimes he is an infant, floating in his mother's belly, not a care in the world, every need served by the larger body hosting him. He wants his body like an infant's, too. So he has to be shaved. Vincent runs the razor along his cheeks, his chest, his belly, his groin.
"Make me completely naked," he says.
The windows are shuttered, blinding the sun and softening the noise outside the dome. People have been gathering outside the gates the last hour. Their chants storm the air. Their feet stomp and shake the ground. They rattle the fence with their hands. A few, he knows, have climbed over it, only to be struck down by deputies, hacked by machetes. He chanced a look outside earlier. His grounds are a black cluster of deputies, and the gates beyond a seething throng of people. The sun was high enough then to burn every shadow from the city except the blackness held in their open mouths. The razor scrapes the top of his thigh. The soap and hair ooze from it when Vincent splashes a handful of water.
"Can't you just kill them?"
Thomas has his arms draped over the lip of the tub, his head pillowed by the rim. The rest of his body floats, suspended by Vincent's grip.
"Who? Who is them? Everyone is them. We can't kill everyone."
He stares at the ceiling, where steam swirls, as though an atmosphere is forming, as though this room is a world of its own. The door knocks open and Slade barges through it, and Vincent slips his razor and draws a red line across Thomas's lower belly.
"What?"
Thomas says at a shriek.
"Can't you see we're busy?"
Slade pulls a towel off a hook and stands at the foot of the tub with it bunched in one hand.
"Get out!" "I'm not done."
Slade goes to the windows and rips open the shutters, and the sunlight shocks the room. The noise outside, the screaming, the chanting, grows fiercer. Thomas rises from the tub, not yet shaved entirely, one of his legs hairy, the other pink and clean. He pats himself down with the towel and presses it hard against the razor slash, and the blood pedals through the threading of the towel.
"Party's over," Slade says. "The gates have been breached."
The guests are racing up the stairs as they race down. One has jewels encrusting her eyebrows. Another wears a dress of white feathers. Another is painted with swirling gold designs, maybe costumed as a sandstorm. They flail their arms and trip their feet, scurrying past, leaving behind tables stacked high with desserts, a stage empty except for its instruments. Broken glass and broken plates glitter the floor. Thomas wears only a robe, no shoes, and he bloodies his feet on a glass shard and cries out and sits down to nurse it, only to be snatched up by Slade and shoved down a hallway.
"Hurry up, you fool!"
The air shakes with footsteps and screams. Thomas gets a glimpse of the rotunda, a mess of deputies bullied back by the tide of people surging forward, not pausing at the machetes that come down on them. They swing bricks and boards and pipes and fists, whatever they might make into a weapon. A glimpse is all he gets. Slade jostles him through a door, the door to the basement, instructing him to escape through the sewer.
"And then what?"
Thomas hates the way his voice sounds, like one more broken glass.
"Then you live."
With that, Slade slams the door and leaves him in a darkness broken only by the lantern dangling from a nearby hook. He carries its glow down the stairs, limping with every step, his cut heel leaving behind bursts of blood. He enters an open room full of coffins, the graves of the ruling class. He stumbles on his sore heel and rams into one and knocks it over, and the lid opens and spills out a body with dust puffing from its open mouth. The body of Mayor Merriweather, his predecessor, Lewis's father. His yellowed teeth seem to be grinning at Thomas.
"No,"
Thomas says, and hurries away and knocks over three more coffins before he makes it through the doorway opposite him. He enters the storage room stacked high with water barrels. The flame of his lantern partners the feeling inside him, a flaring of light in the face of impossible darkness. His hair remains wet from his bath, and deep beneath the dome he actually feels chilled. He searches the room until he finds what he is looking for, the square black grate cut into the floor. He kneels and yanks at it, then yanks again, and again. It barely moves, rattling in place. At first, he believes it rusted shut. Then he spies the chain wrapped around its grating. He yanks and yanks, and then a shiver runs through him, and he says, "No, no, no." He can hear thumping above, feet pounding the floor, fists pounding doors. It is only a matter of time before they find him. He stands and feels the sharpness in his heel at the same time that he feels a sharpness at his back. He spins around. He does not realize how deeply he has been stabbed until he sees the knife, a black blade, bloodied all the way to its hilt. His wife holds it in her hand, and as he turns to face her, she plunges it once more into his chest. He hardly recognizes her. Her white hair is hidden beneath a wrap. Instead of a silk dress, she wears denim pants, a brown shirt made of some coarse fabric. She looks ready for the streets. He almost says something to mock her, but blood gurgles from his mouth in the place of words. He lurches toward her, and she shoves him back, and he wilts against a stack of barrels. One of them tips and falls with him to the floor. Its top cracks open. The water glugs from it, spilling across the floor, splashing his face. It feels good. It feels cleansing. He closes his eyes. He listens to his heartbeat, so fast at first, like the footsteps drumming all through the dome, and then slower. And then silent. Chapter 60. Burr has a good view from the Flavel House. Way up high on a hill, he can see so much of his city and the bay beyond. He stands at an open window in the library. Lewis has escaped him, but not for long. He can feel him out there, not far away. He will find him. He will seduce him and humble him and teach him. Once taught, he will be made into something wonderful, a great tool. He, like everyone else, will become an extension of Burr, a million-limbed monster. This will, of course, take time. Burr must be gentler, must not present everything in such a forceful rush. He was just so excited, and when Lewis resisted him, Burr could not help but reduce him to a mewling ball. He has dreamed 1,000 times what they might accomplish together, so that the future feels like the present, their relationship already underway. It is difficult, courting a person you believe belongs to you. Burr must be patient, must keep in mind his need for Lewis. He has, after all, no sons or daughters. He has tried to cultivate some unnaturally, exposing pregnant slaves to high doses of radiation, hoping for something radiant, not flippered or cleft-lipped or turned inside out, but gifted, special, someone who can carry on, inherit what he has built so far. That is immortality. And though he has his students, Joea among them, none have the same potential as Lewis. He is the next. Everything will be all right. He is certain of this, even with the smoke rising from the bombed sections of his city. They will rebuild, as they have rebuilt before. And they will exterminate those who threaten them, and they will continue to manufacture, to claim, to grow. There was a time when he was out on a jetty, the seals and sea lions sunbathing on the rocks or bobbing in the water all around him, when a shark surfaced. Its fin cut the waves, its eyes rolled over white. It showed its fleshy gums, a smile of 1,000 teeth, and then bit down, tearing into a seal, biting again, drawing it deeper inside its mouth. Bubbles frothed white and red when the shark descended. For minutes afterward, Burr shook with fright and awe. There were certain things in the world that could do that to you. You crossed paths with them, even if only for a moment, and they infected you, made your body shake with dark energy. Objects could have that same power. A nail from the cross, the throne of Charlemagne, the diary of a young Jewish girl, the looped video of the Twin Towers collapsing, replaced by ashen pillars. That is the purpose of a museum, a power plant full of receptacles that can enhance people, even glancingly. Lewis has that same power, and Burr has felt it out there for a long time, floating in the dark sea of the world, and it has been borne to him by current, and he would have it, and when he did, others would tremble as he once did, mesmerized by the red wake of the shark. He commands the Northwest now, the country soon, but he is not merely interested in power, he is interested in the larger permanence of humanity. Sometimes a single person comes along and changes history. It is a position that requires more than grand intelligence, but detachment and ruthlessness, the utilitarian ability to hurt others as a way of helping others. He is that person. Lewis will be that person. And their names will become so important that they will never expire so long as humans retain their foothold on the world. Burr smiles, but his attention is distracted by a bird. He sees it circling above the house and then dropping to his open window, a flash in the air before him, a tiny owl. Its wings creak and its beak twitters. On instinct, he holds out his hand to accept it, and it lands heavily in the cup of them. Its feathers are cold to the touch, made of metal. It is then he smells the smoke. It is then he sees the spitting fuse trailing it like a kite's string. Before he can drop it or hurl it aside, the black powder encased in its hollow breast ignites and transforms the library into a white oblivion. Chapter 61. Slade unbelts his machete and swings his way through the throng of rioters, severing a hand, splitting a face, opening up a throat to a geyser of blood. And though he is outnumbered many times over, everyone flinches away from him. In that way, he still owns them, so long as he does not reveal the fear taking wing inside him. He crashes out of the dome and through its fallen gates into a sunlight so bright he throws up an arm to shade his eyes. For a full minute, he runs at a dead sprint, not going anywhere, aiming himself away from the crowds. He trips twice and skins his knees badly, but refuses to cry out. Then, in an alley empty of anything but shadows, he chokes for breath and orients himself. The wall cuts into the too blue sky. Smoke ribbons from burned buildings. A dog pants in the shade of an alley. A jingle cart rolls by. Otherwise, the city seems empty. But he can hear a distant roar, the noise many angry voices take on when in chorus. The man pulling the jingle cart wears a floppy brown hat that looks like it has been torn in half and sewn back together again. He pauses and calls to Slade, "Candies! Medicines!" And then he sees the blood-painted machete and lets go of the cart, and it rolls a yard before going still. Slade tracks his way through a city that no longer belongs to him. A low-hanging awning tears his hat from his head. His knees feel wasp-stung. He tries not to think about what will happen next, tries to focus only on returning to the place he feels safest. He finds the police station empty, even the cells beneath. A desk overturned, a door ripped from its hinges, the occasional body slumped in a corner or sprawled on the floor with a knee bent strangely. When he calls out, his voice swirls down the hallways like water down a drain. The noise continues to rage outside, and he hurries to the dark nook in the basement he calls home. He latches shut the door and leans his forehead against it and feels some sense of peace cooling him. He has separated himself, shuttered away the sun and the noise, in what feels an impenetrable nest. He rattles the dangling chains and makes music of them. He walks among his mannequins, his favorites, reassured by their company. Here he remains powerful. He strokes an arm, grazes a cheek, before finding his bed. He sits at its edge, crushing the mattress with his weight, The metal frame protests, and his sigh sounds similar, when it rises into a shriek because of the pain at his ankles. First one, then the other, a sharp slice followed by a hot flood of blood. He tries to stand, but cannot. His legs won't work. He tumbles to the floor and barely throws out his hands in time to catch himself. He crabs his way forward, escaping whatever has injured him. He twists around to see her sliding from beneath the bed and then standing still among his mannequins, shoulder to shoulder with her own. She is here. She is his, at last. His Ella. His fierce, beautiful girl. She tosses aside the scalpel, one of his own tools, used to slash and sever his tendons. He smiles. He cannot help himself. But she does not smile back. Her face is grim when she hefts the baseball bat, testing its weight, knotting her fingers around the grip. "Remember what you taught me about terror?" she says. "You were wrong. Love wins." Chapter 62. When the sisters show Lewis their stores of black powder, he knows what to do. He kisses his owl before sending it to the skies one last time. So many minutes later, he feels something shift, like a lantern extinguished or a vice released in his mind, and he senses it is done. Burr is dead. He wonders how many others suddenly feel the same, how strong and wide the grip of this one man. Lewis understands that once the queen bee of a hive dies, there is another to take her place. But for now, he has done what he can. He has bet on humanity. This is why he walks to a cliff overlooking the place where the river meets the ocean. He watches the currents mash together, a foamy roiling. Waves boom and turn over endlessly. The wind bites him with sand and dampens him with salt spray. He reaches into his pocket and removes the coffin-shaped box and opens it and fingers out the vial and grips it in his palm. He cannot help but hesitate, debate whether he should open it up, snort its contents, make himself into a human missile, and take out the rest of the human population, destroy what destroys. Isn't the world better off without people? There is a balance. Trees make a mess that fire cleans. Rain extinguishes fire and swells green shoots from the ground. A deer eats the grass, then dies and rots into the dirt from which trees grow to make a mess. A balance that everything but man and virus acknowledge. Then he hears some laughter in the distance. Clark delighting in something small. Maybe a joke told, or a grasshopper caught in her hair, or the sun slanting through the clouds. That is all the convincing he needs. A hard woman giving herself up to joy. For a long time, Lewis has felt overwhelmed by immensity, the measurable immensity of time and distance, as he rode and hiked and paddled so many thousands of miles over hundreds of days, and the incalculable immensity that can exist between people who betray or grieve or hate each other. And when he considers all the places he has traveled, and dangers surmounted, and people encountered, and words written over the past few months, he feels overcome, vertiginous, swept away. It is the laughter that brings him back, makes him feel anchored. He is connected to Joea, just as he is connected to Clark, a kind of family, the beginning of the community and renewal he imagined he might find here all along. There is hope, after all. Life might be a catastrophe, but it is a beautiful catastrophe. He cocks his arm and pitches the vial out. Once exposed to the air, the virus should expire within minutes. Far below, it bursts on some rocks, a glassy dust that sparkles. The river dimples and swallows its remains, one more pollutant. "What was that?" a voice behind him. Clark's. the end of the world. They walk back together. The sun hangs over the ocean, and the moon hangs over the coastal mountains, as if in an uneasy truce. In the cracked parking lot of the sewage treatment facility, the sisters stand beside their idling truck, the doors of it open. They heft something from the rear cab, what turns out to be a shortwave radio, and plunk it on the front seat and plug it into the cigarette lighter. It sparks out a puff of smoke they wave away. One of them settles into the seat beside the radio and aims the antenna at the sky and fiddles with the frequency and begins a transmission. Sam and Olivia Field, sending report. Is anyone there? Is anyone there? Is anyone there? Over. The other leans one arm against the open door, turning when she notices Lewis leaning in to watch them. Moon's out, she says. She's trying for a moon bounce. Sam and Olivia Field sending report. Is anyone there? I repeat, is anyone there? Over. Lewis has been awake for 2 days. He feels too numb and exhausted to talk, to process what he sees. He can manage a small question. Which one of you is Olivia? She stabs her chest with a thumb. That's me. I'm sorry. I should have asked you that before. She shrugs. It's a pretty name. Sam speaks into the radio again, waits, hears no response except the pop and buzz of static. The wind rises, and Lewis wavers where he stands. I don't understand. Who is she speaking to?
Boss.
Who do you work for?
The government. We work for the government.
She says this as though she is talking about what they should expect for weather, or what they might cook for dinner.
What?
Lewis gives a short laugh.
What government?
The American government. He looks at her a moment to see if she was joking. The flat expression on her face tells him she is not.
You never asked, she says, and uncrosses her arms and peels back one of her sleeves to reveal on her biceps a tattoo. An American flag, inked in black.
Epilogue. Washington, D.C. is a swamp. The streets are sluggish rivers, the buildings mossy canyons, negotiated by rafts and canoes and john boats. Mosquitoes dirty the air with their humming swarms. Through the muck walk egrets on stilted legs. Alligators laze on the steps of the Smithsonian. The monument is a broken fang rising from a lake. The rafters and arches of every memorial are busy with the nests of thrashers and waxwings. The dome of the Capitol has cracked open like a hatched egg. Everything smells of crushed earthworms. Night is falling. Balls of blue fire burn. Pockets of swamp gas begin to glow. So do the lamplit windows of the White House. Though it is hardly white, vined and ridden with algae and bearded with moss. A turbine spins on its roof, its blades groan up to speed as the wind rises. Thunder mutters. A storm is coming. A storm is always coming, with hurricanes whirling off the Atlantic every other week. Rain speckles the water, then thickens, lashing at the windows. In one of them, a man looks up, though he can see nothing but his reflection. A black face against a black window. His beard, gouged by a meaty scar, is beginning to gray. He is shirtless and has a bit of a paunch, noticeable only when he is sitting. But his chest and shoulders are round with muscle. Sweat beads on his skin, drips down his back like the rain down the window. This is a bedroom that doubles as an office. A four-poster bed rises beside the wooden desk where he sits in an orange circle of light thrown by a lamp. There is an inkpot, a pile of paper, books, a shortwave radio. He fiddles with the knobs, scratching through frequencies, settling now and then on voices that sometimes speak English and sometimes languages he does not recognize. He needs no translator to recognize the occasional panic and anger in their words. There is a knock at the door, and when he does not respond to it, another knock follows, and when he does not respond to this, the door opens. A face peeks through. brown-skinned, bald-headed. Monroe, his valet. He wears a pocketed vest over a collared shirt.
Mr. President?
He does not turn. His naked back carries an American flag tattoo across its shoulders. It is inked in black and broken by wormy scars.
They're waiting for you, sir.
The door closes. He continues to listen for another minute, channeling between silence and voices. Lightning forks the sky outside, and the thunder that follows shakes the windows and fuzzes the radio. He snaps off the volume and rises from his desk and pulls on a shirt and begins to button it. The room is walled with bookshelves and anchored by a long table made from rough-hewn pine. Around it sits his cabinet, a small, bug-eyed woman, a man with a tumor bulging redly from his neck, a brown-bearded man missing a thumb, and a black woman with a gray nimbus of hair. They stand when he enters, and then tuck their bodies back into their chairs when he motions for them to sit. He takes a chair at the head of the table, and it groans beneath his weight. An enormous map sits at the center of the table. It has been torn into many pieces and fitted together again to create a warped representation of the country. Water-stained, rimed with mold, the Midwest and Southwest are shaded a poisonous yellow, the plains white, the Northwest green, the South, ranging from Texas to North Carolina, a watery blue. So many sections are surrounded by red circles, indicating an uninhabitable blast zone, the biggest of them corralling the entire East Coast. They motion to the map when they speak, talking about hazards and possibilities. A railroad line reconstructed here, a community built around a coal mine there. There are black X's and red X's sketched throughout the West, and there are skulls drawn on several states in the South, and the cabinet members stab their fingers at these when they talk about rising threats. All this time, the man they call president says nothing, his posture stiff and his hands balled on the table before him. His eyes flit from speaker to speaker, the only indication he is listening. There is one window with a crack running across it that weeps rain. Every now and then, it goes blue-white with lightning. The room shivers with thunder, and the lights sputter on and off. The room goes quiet when something crashes in the hallway. Voices call out. There is a hurried knock at the door that does not wait for an invitation. Monroe enters backward, nearly falling. He is being kicked at by a hooded figure braced by two guards. A voice, a woman's voice, curses them, says she'll stomp their mouths, make a necklace of their teeth. Four more guards follow, clutching two other hooded figures, though these stand quietly and make no move against them. Monroe brushes off his vest and says,
"We found them outside."
He begins to say something more, but thunder crashes and steals away his words. The guards pull off their hoods. The woman, Clark, wears her red hair short around her ears. She looks wildly around the room and tries to rip her arms away from the guards, but they only grip her more tightly. Joea regards them with black eyes that reflect the astonished expressions of those in the room. Louis is white-haired and clean-shaven, and though he keeps his eyes steady on the president, he tells Clark to settle down and says in a cool voice that they mean no harm and need not be detained. One of the guards says,
"This is what they had on them."
He clunks onto the table three holstered belts, each carrying two long-nosed revolvers, then three more rifles.
"And this?"
A metallic bird, golden and no bigger than an infant, built in the shape of an eagle. He sets it on its side, and it does not move, except for an aperture widening in one of its glass eyes. Monroe stands by the president now. He leans in and speaks at a whisper everyone can hear.
"They said you would want to see them. They said they came a long way to speak to you."
The president rises from his chair. He walks slowly, his footsteps thudding, and as he does, the windows again blaze with lightning, followed instantly by thunder. He does not keep his distance, but stops within an arm's reach of Louis, who asks, "Are you President Jefferson?" His voice is like a rock slide.
What do you want?
Outside, the thunder crashes again. Lewis opens his hands, and wires of electricity dance between his fingers. When he speaks, Clark and Joanne speak with him, their voices the same. We're here to help.
This has been a Hachette audio production of The Deadlands, a novel, written by Benjamin Percy, read by Halter Graham, produced by Cheryl Smith, directed by Jared O'Connell, recorded by Bob Berido, post-production by Beat Street Productions. The Deadlands is also available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2015 by Benjamin Percy. Audio production copyright 2015 Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook without the permission of the publisher constitutes unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.